Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Game Devastation Podcast. My name is Stefan Frost. Today, I am joined by some bros from Shieldbreak Studios. Gentlemen, why don't you introduce yourselves?
Hey, I'm Will Harris. I'm the lead designer at Shieldbreak.
I'm Vince Fennell. I am the producer and also a designer at Shieldbreak.
Very cool. So today, I have a bunch of questions. I've written them down. Like professionals do, and we're just gonna hop right into it. So, what do you guys exactly do on a day-to-day basis as the producer and as the lead designer?
So day-to-day, one of the things that I do is as a producer is run our daily stand-up. We have a daily stand-up meeting, and we also have play tests twice daily. So I do the project management, run the meetings, run the playtests, make sure that we're sort of on task and verifying fixes, just all that sort of project management, boring stuff.
No. Well, actually, so here's the interesting thing about the show, because I think one of the big sort of motivators for me was to get this out so that people who are not in the industry and want to get into the industry can kind of get a glimpse into like what you actually do.
Sure.
Can you define what a stand-up is for people that don't know?
Sure. We don't actually stand up because we all work remotely.
So we're sitting most of the time.
Yeah. Right. But anyway, what it is a very short, it's called a stand-up meeting because it's meant to be done with everybody standing so that it won't last that long. And what it is a meeting where everybody on the team basically states what they did yesterday, what they're going to do today, and if they're blocked on anything. So that way everybody is somewhat aware of what everybody's up to. And if there are any problems that are holding anyone back from working for the day, we can talk about them or prioritize what needs to be done to make sure that they can.
Cool. So let me ask you guys this for your production process. You're talking about stand-ups. Do you guys use like an agile board sort of thing to track stuff? So can you explain what that is for people that don't know?
Sure. We use a tool called Trello, which is sort of a Kanban style board. It's basically, it's like a visual for index cards. And it's digital, which is nice. It's online, so everybody can see it. But it's free, yeah. Basically, it allows you to build lists that are columns that look like index cards, basically. And you can attach images to them, which is nice, too, especially for our art team. And you can move things around in those lists. You can make the list whatever you want. Because we're a small team and we're flexible, we've changed our project management style multiple times throughout development.
Cool.
Because we're not in any sort of rigid structure. And my philosophy has always been, hey guys, if this isn't working, let's try something else. Let's try another way.
So typically with these lists that you're talking about, and feel free to throw out if this is different or similar to what you guys do, you have your backlog or things that you can kind of pull from to do.
Yep.
And then you have your in progress, and then your awaiting review, and then you have your completed.
Yeah. Right? So what we call it is, our backlogs are actually, right now it's lists with just people. So I make a list for each person on the team, and they have a backlog of tasks. And we usually generate those tasks in our team meetings when we talk about our next milestone. And what happens is if somebody's working on something, they move it into doing, we call the list. So I'm doing this right now. And then when it's done, it goes into what I call a to verify list. And then I will verify everything in that list in one of our play tests, and I'll move it into verified. And once it's in verified, it's basically a closed issue. And then I just occasionally will just archive all those cards, but it's kind of nice week to week to let that list build up, so you get an idea of what got done.
Right. And the kind of point of it is to show where everything is at in the development process, and then everybody can kind of see where everything's at.
Everybody can see where everything's at. And it's also useful, to just see what people are working on at any one time. But any project management tool is only as good as the person managing it or the team using it. So half the battle is just getting everybody to use that stuff and stay on top of it. And it can be challenging, especially on a small team with everybody doing multiple roles.
And I've found too, from personal experience, that because I used to be a designer and then I kind of switched into the production thing. When producers would come to me and say, like, I want you to fill out this thing in Jira or in what you guys are using, for example.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'm just a creative professional. Don't manage me, man. I know what I'm doing. You know, but once you get people kind of thinking in that way, it really does help out the organization process and kind of get people on the same page. So I know what you mean. I feel your pain. Okay. So what does the lead designer do at Shield Break Studios?
My main task right now is just working on the combat, like making the classes compelling, making the attacks compelling. Because we're a small team, there's so many design tasks that are kind of divvied out throughout the team. I would say almost everyone on the team is really a designer.
Cool.
So even our animator will go in there and play with attack speeds and stuff, since our game is so animation driven.
Yeah.
So my job is just kind of balance things, take feedback from the team about where it's going, and then try to process that in a way that can keep us on the right direction, you know?
Okay. So, let's talk a minute. Cause I think one of my questions, it's later, whatever. I'm doing it live.
You're crazy. I'm crazy, man.
So one of the questions I was going to ask is like hits with impact. How do you sell impact in these games? Because a game like yours, I don't even know if people know what your game is exactly. So describe that really quick before I even ask this question about
sure.
impact.
Our game is called Beer Zerkers, B-I-E-R. They're not our characters aren't very good at spelling. They're a bit simple-minded. And it's a game about Vikings who have gone to Viking Heaven, to Asgard, and they just drink and fight
nice.
When they're there. And they're having a good time while they do it. So it's to dive into that a little bit more, it's a third-person multiplayer melee combat game. And it is sort of like Team Fortress 2 meets Chivalry meets Smash Brothers.
Meets WoW Arena.
Meets WoW Arena, sure. Yeah.
Right on.
those are all the like big influences for the game.
So it's very melee-centric, very PvP-centric.
Yeah. Yep.
So I was going to ask about impacts. Mm. How do you make it feel when you're hitting somebody, it feels like it's meaty and chunky and it feels good when you do that?
We're dealing with that right now.
Yeah, that's actually something we're working on right now is user feedback, like what it feels like to get hit, what it feels like to deliver hits. And there's a bunch of things you can do. First off, the attack animation has to feel really good. Then when it impacts, you need sound, effects, knockback, interrupt. We have something called hit stun, where when you get hit, it actually prevents you from swinging for a short duration. So you really feel it when you get hit because it limits your ability to attack back.
Right.
You get punished.
And you have to replicate all that over a network.
Yeah, that's the really tough part. Especially like knockback, getting that to feel smooth where you're getting hit around in space on the network cleanly is a tough battle and something we've been struggling with since day one.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that too, because I think with a game, you know, my history was working on a game like WildStar. Mm. We had melee characters and we had ranged characters.
Yeah.
And when we were doing PvP, that was a big challenge for us to make sure that we had a melee feeling good. Mm. So across a network, I gotta imagine that is super challenging to make sure that, you know, the game registers that the player input a hit, that hit travels to the server and then communicates to the other client and says like, yeah, I've been hit. And that it displays the proper animation and all that stuff. How do you guys work around that? How do you deal with that?
We do a lot of things client side, which has its own set of problems. That means it's easier to hack.
Yes. Yeah.
but it feels much better if the hit that you deliver as the person swinging registers correctly. Like in some games, you'll see you'll hit somebody and then there's a delay right. on their reaction. And that just doesn't feel good.
No.
So we go in favor of the person swinging.
Okay.
And we also, the way that works is our defensive system goes in favor of the person inputting the defense.
Okay. Right?
So it's tricky. You will, no matter what, with lag, get situations where you felt like you should have blocked or you felt like you should have hit. You know, there's no way around that with a multiplayer game.
Right.
But doing a lot of the stuff client side actually helps.
Cool.
Well, we've also had feedback with the methods that we're using where people with high pings have felt like they've had a pretty good experience. So,
and that's because of the client side.
Yeah. So we're trying to stay cognizant of those issues. And we even, early on, we had a much more tactical game. And we wanted, for example, to allow people to parry was something that we wanted to do. And to be able to parry, that means you have to have enough time across the network to see someone start their swing. And then enough time for you just as a human to react to that and press the appropriate input. And we actually calculated how long your windup has to be in a swing for that to ever even work. There was a minimum amount of time. I can't remember exactly what it is. It's a fraction of a second.
It was almost half a second.
Right. So that would mean that all of your attacks needed to have, that would be the fastest windup you could possibly have, which a half second windup it isn't slow, but it isn't fast.
Right.
And as the game progressed, we actually leaned more towards a faster attack style and ended up cutting parry because we didn't want to be limited by that limitation to make the game feel good. So the game became a little less tactical and more arcadey, essentially, because of that.
Yeah, we had really high damage attacks. So, I mean, within a couple of hits, you could die. Almost like Chivalry. Like, Chivalry is a very punishing game. And Chivalry has parry, right?
Yeah.
But their attack speeds are pretty slow. The wind-up is a huge telegraph. And we felt like the faster swings were much more fun, but there was no way to include parry. So we changed up the defense style of the game.
Right.
And we sped up the game, and we increased the health pools so that you can get hit and still react and fight back.
Right. Yeah, because I think with Chivalry, it's like you could die in a single hit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
you can get your head cut off. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. So very interesting. What kind of brought you guys to the idea of Valhalla and Vikings and, you know, the sort of thematic stylings that you picked?
Well, very early on, when we were putting the team together, we were actually talking about making a shooter in the vein of like TF2 or Overwatch.
Okay.
But we figured with our small team that space is very competitive. You're basically competing with the big boys who have massive budgets, massive team sizes, and we felt like we couldn't really hit that bar.
There's a huge market there, but it's hard to compete in that market. Even if you don't need a large chunk of it, it's just difficult to find an audience that isn't already, you know, playing something else that's there.
Yeah, and we had a couple people on the team that were huge fans of Chivalry. They got the rest of us to play it, and then we saw the potential to make a melee game that was inspired by those mechanics,
right?
But not the same game, right?
Sure.
We felt like we could make it much more accessible because Chivalry is a pretty hardcore game.
Yeah.
We felt like we could go a different direction with it, layering in abilities, making it just for a wider audience, and taking inspiration from games like Smash Brothers, where anybody can pick it up, just start messing around,
right?
And achieve something. Same with fighting games, right? Like Street Fighter. Anybody can pick up Street Fighter and start mashing buttons and have a good time.
Right.
But someone that's really skilled is going to destroy them.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's kind of our goal, is to make a game that's very accessible, that anyone can jump into, but there's a high skill cap for skilled play and people that put time into learning the mechanics. So that was our initial kind of inspiration to make the game. The Viking theme came about from kind of researching what exists in the stylized art style out there that we can draw inspiration from that would fit a melee game. And so we were looking at movies. So How to Train Your Dragon was a huge inspiration.
Right.
Tangled, you know, a lot of the like animated films.
Brave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That had just come out actually. So we decided, hey, you know, there's the How to Train Your Dragon is really cool. Can we take that kind of art style and make it a little edgier and more violent, but still keep that kind of easy to understand, accessible look to it. Yeah.
Whose idea was it to get the jump on it emote?
Probably our animator.
Yeah.
Or was it your idea?
That was my idea. Yeah. Oh.
It's right up your guys' alley.
Yeah, I'm a big hip hop head, so.
Okay.
We decided Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was going to be our animation inspiration.
Our scoundrel does the Carlton dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not familiar with it, you can just go look it up online. Just Google Jump On It Carlton and you'll find what we're talking about. Or you can Google your guys' game. I'm sure somebody does that emote immediately and
know
what you're talking about. So, okay, cool. Just curious because that had come up. So here's another question regarding your guys' team. How did they come together, and you know, how did you guys form into what you've become now?
You could probably start that, and then I could probably
Okay, yeah. So our CEO that formed the company, Greg Ash, it was his idea to put this company together. And he was just leaving Blizzard, or had plans to leave Blizzard, and he wanted to make his own game. He had an extreme like gamer knowledge. Like, the dude could break down a game in its most micro form and understand what made it tick.
From a player's point of view.
Yeah, from a player point of view. And he had a great business sense. He had tons of experience. I mean, he was, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was director of business intelligence at Blizzard. So he was exposed to a lot of great information about the industry and how it worked, what made it tick. And at his time at Blizzard, he met a lot of great people and was able to form connections and basically find the kind of people that would make a great indie team. So he was kind of pitching to people what his idea was. And
He pitched the competitive shooter idea to me before I even started at Blizzard.
Yeah, he had wanted to do it for a long time. And so what's interesting is a lot of the people on the team didn't know each other, but they knew Greg.
Yeah.
And I was introduced to Greg through our animator, James, probably 3 months before we got started. So I had just, at the very beginning, just met him, you know.
Okay.
And he really hooked me in, like, super charismatic dude, very knowledgeable. And I could tell that he was driven and wanted to make something awesome.
Yeah, he basically convinced us all to leave our cushy, well-paid jobs to do something crazy. and
with
I had
with
actually
an unproven team where most of us didn't know each other, you know. Yeah. So that takes a special kind of person for sure. You know?
Yeah, and he had actually recruited me at Blizzard and brought me on board to help out with their esports program. And throughout that process, basically, not long after I had started there, he left to start his company, and then I kind of left to go with him not long after, and similar to Will, like, met all these guys. And most of the guys met through a lot of competitive online play, was sort of a common thread through everybody, whether they had done, there was this thing called Studio Rumble, which was a...
For LOL, right?
It was, they've done it for multiple games,
right.
But it was basically like a competitive league for game developers where they would play, like Team Fortress 2 was a big one,
right.
Where they'd basically play competitive Team Fortress 2, and each studio would have a team. So Red 5 had a team, Blizzard had a team.
Right.
I don't know what other, I wasn't actually involved with that, but there were quite a few, studios that were participating. So
5 or 6 of the guys on our team played on a team together at Blizzard.
Okay. Yeah.
So Greg brought everybody together, kind of the initial team, and we picked up a couple people after the company started and kind of started working on this idea. We brought on board our financial guy, who's also from Blizzard, who's been a huge help for us too. And then eventually what happened was last E3, Greg passed away in a car accident, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Which was a tough time for us, obviously, as a group. But we decided to kind of keep it together. We really felt good about the project, felt good about the team and the game. And so we've been kind of pressing on through that, despite that. And had a big rally for PAX Prime that year that really helped us out a lot.
Yeah, and I'm sure that he would have wanted that too, right? You know, like, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, his family came to us right away and said, we want you guys to keep going. We want you to do this. So that's, you know, that helped, and that's, you know, that's what we're doing. We're going for it.
Big motivating factor for me, ever since day one of the project, when we would go out with Greg, he would just, without question, every time, he'd be like, this game is shipping no matter what. Like, he would always say that. So.
Yeah, because we have a lot of people that worked on teams like Red 5 or the next gen MMO team at Blizzard that like didn't get a chance to ship their games, and they had been working on those projects a really long time. So that was like the one promise that we made, is that we're going to ship this game one way or another.
Cool. Well, that's awesome. You guys are sticking with it, because so far, from what I've seen, it's been a lot of fun playing the game. And I actually found out about the game through playing at PAX Prime.
Oh, cool.
I met your... I think it was like your lead animator or something like that. I can't remember his name, but
James.
Yeah. Sure, James. but yeah, I'd I'd murdered like six people, and I don't know if that influenced my liking of the game more. I think it was just because it was a fun experience, but yeah, it was cool talking with them and seeing, you know, what this game had become. So, right now you guys are in alpha.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. We're in an alpha testing phase right now. Yes.
So talk to me about what alpha means to you guys. And when you put a game out in alpha, what are you looking to do? What are you looking to get? How do you test it? What are the metrics you look at? What are the things you do to make an alpha successful?
You want me to take that one? You got it?
I'd just like to say that our alpha is a little bit different than like a full box product. You know, usually that alpha is like a very, very polished product that's like ready to ship out the door, and they're more testing infrastructure and things like that. Our game is kind of planned to go into early access. So this is the alpha for our early access build. So we're just testing to make sure our combat is compelling enough for people.
Mm-hmm.
We are testing our infrastructure, but it's at its very early infancy. And you can keep going with it.
Yeah. So there's a few things. Like Will said, we're looking for feedback from the people who are involved on combat and design. We're working out our online systems. So like Will said, we're aiming towards an early access goal right now. And what we don't want when we get into early access is for there to be huge online system issues. So we're taking that time now before anybody gives us any money to essentially test that stuff out and try to get it in good shape before we put it out there. And then finally, yes, we are gathering a lot of data as well. So just one of the guys on the team was in business intelligence at Blizzard, and he's a huge data nerd. So he's set up a bunch of stuff to capture every sort of data point possible in the game, and we're constantly looking at that and scraping the data and turning it every direction to see what's useful and what's interesting and what we can get out of it.
What is the most surprising thing that you guys have seen? Because I feel like whenever you put out a game for people to play, I can't remember who the World War One general was. I think it was a German general that said, "No battle plan survives first contact with the enemy." Right?
Right.
So what about you put out the game and you're like, "Ah, this is going to be awesome." What has gone well for you guys that you liked? And what have you been like, "Okay, we've got to change that because people don't like this as much."
I think in terms of things that are going well, like the most exciting thing is that we intentionally went with something IP-wise that's very loose and very malleable, because we plan on expanding the game further, and we didn't want to kind of corner ourselves into something and have to stick with that.
Right.
So we just kept it humorous and very loose. Like, we don't make direct references to certain Viking gods or anything like that. Like, we may go that direction eventually, but we just tried to say, okay, let's make funny pop culture references. Let's make characters that each have distinct personalities and stuff. And what's really surprising is that people are really like picking up on it and digging into it and watching people stream on Twitch. Like, they're totally like role playing a drunk Viking, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's awesome. And then the second part of that question, I think for me, and you probably have a different thought about this, is what's gone wrong. Like, just typical, I think it's super typical game dev thing, which is when you first see a lot of people play your game, you have forgotten about all of the like bad user experience stuff that you haven't addressed
right.
as you develop it. And you just get used to it. Like, "Oh, I always just press this button or click through this thing because I've done it for 6 months and it's always been there and it doesn't bother me." Whereas that might totally prevent somebody from playing your game because it's not clear to them what they need to do.
Yeah.
So there's probably a couple thousand little things that we've identified that we need to work on that front. So that's the thing, especially because we've been to a couple of conventions. We did PAX Prime, we did IndieCade, and we did PAX South. And when you're there and you can explain those things, you also are skipping over that, right? You're sort of there to address it and help people with that stuff. But when you're doing this alpha test, it's for the first time, and especially because we're encouraging people to stream it, and right. we're trying to just get us, that helps us see these things. So when we are watching somebody's stream play the alpha and they're, you know, clicking a button and it's not doing what they expect to do, I'm just literally like killing myself inside. I'm just like, just tearing myself apart. Like, "Oh, why didn't I fix that or do something about that?"
And to be fair, like, we haven't internally focused on those issues because, you know, we've been so dedicated to just getting like the core gameplay going.
Yeah.
Now that we know that that's working, mm-hmm. it's time to like really clean it up and make it easy intro, easy to jump into, and easy to understand.
Right.
And I think multiplayer games tend to be very polished when they come out. Traditionally, like if you look at like TF2, Left 4 Dead, Evolve, like all these big AAA games, their user experience is super polished yeah. all the way around. And people have that expectation.
Yeah.
So we have to hit that bar, even yeah. though we're a small team.
Yep.
So when you're taking all this information in from the alphas and you're watching these streams and you're doing this stuff, how much of that is going directly into the tasks that you're working on now versus how much are you just trying to get the stuff that you wanted to get working going first? Because I'm sure you're going to collect that data. The mm-hmm. question is, like, when do you act on it? Is it later? Is it sooner? Like, what do you do for that?
So this kind of goes a little bit into the production style of the team. So what we do after an external playtest, whether it's the alpha that we ran recently or just had, we've had other external playtests where we just bring groups of people together that whoever we could round up. We typically in the daily, the morning after, we'll then talk about the playtest and what everybody noticed. If anybody got any feedback from anyone, we actually built feedback into the alpha. So we kind of had a list of feedback from people that they gave us directly. And we basically just, we talk about it. I take notes during that conversation to just capture that raw, like, okay, this is the impression I got of other people's impressions.
Right.
And to just capture all that stuff, get it down. And then, we did a team sort of in-person team meeting, kind of like an all day planning meeting for the next milestone, maybe a few days after that. And that's where we started to say, okay, well, what are the priorities from this list? Like, what do we need to start tackling? Or what we talked about at the last one was, what do we have to do before we do another playtest?
Yeah. And then biggest problems that we saw across the board with everybody.
Right.
Right. And make sure we hammer on those. And we also had another sort of what I called tier of things that, okay, well, if we get through all those, then what's the next level of stuff that we need to do or deal with, to get it even better.
Right. So you guys are using Unreal 4 for this project?
Yes.
Which is cool. I've toyed around with it myself a little bit, and there's loads of cool stuff. We actually were just talking to somebody last time about Unreal 4, and it became this Unreal 4 podcast. Which cool. So I was looking through it and talking about it. Like, how much experience did you guys have with the Unreal Engine before starting this project? And how has it been working with the engine so far?
I used Unreal since probably 2004, like UT 2K4 editor. That's how I got started in level design, was making levels for that. And then professionally, I had worked in a bunch of other engines. I've never worked on a project that's like strictly Unreal Engine in terms of commercial, but I'd had a lot of mod experience with it. But actually, it's changed so much, and the tools have gotten so much more powerful that it's really its own kind of beast, I think. Some things like the material editor and particle effects are still like 10 years old, but, for the most part, like the scripting and everything is so much more powerful. And I really feel like if we were using any other engine, we wouldn't be nearly as far along as we are. Because it's empowered everyone on the team to be able to do stuff. I mean, yeah. our animator, who, will tell you himself, he's probably the least technical person on the team, can script in Unreal 4. Like, he can do his own animation graphs and stuff, yeah. which he would normally need to rely on an animation programmer for.
Right.
So that kind of gives you a glimpse of how powerful it is. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. For me, I was really familiar with id Tech, just having worked on Call of Duty for a long time and dabbled a lot with the tools there. I had very little experience, maybe just launched UDK a few times and tried to do some tutorials, that type of thing, before coming on board with this project. But I very quickly, and we even, you know, got the engine, we got access pretty early. I think before public release, we were in there. So there was no documentation really, and just very little, support yet, because they were still working on releasing it. And, you know, they had to focus on that. They did provide like really great, sort of like question and answer system, which was nice, but we really had to just kind of pick it up completely from scratch. And it's awesome. We love it. It's even for me, like having come from working with other technologies and not really touched Unreal that much, like now I'm doing a lot of the integration of a lot of the content that the team's producing. And it's really just like Will said, like we wouldn't be able to get anywhere near where we are now without it.
Very cool. Very cool. This is more of a general question for you guys, and you're welcome to disagree on this. Because it might be more interesting. What do you think the three most important things about game development are in your position?
I'll answer that as a producer, I guess. Sure. The three most important things for game development. I mean, number one is communication. Just having a team that communicates well will be huge. And if you're having a team that doesn't communicate well, you're going to know that, and the whole project is going to feel it immediately. I'd say communication. Number two, teamwork. People need to be able to work together on things and not clash. I mean, people are always going to clash, but the thing is I'd rather have a team of mediocre people that work really well together.
What are you trying to say?
I think that team is going to produce a better product than a team of rock stars that can't work with each other.
Yeah.
Number three is motivation. If you're not motivated, if you're not inspired, you're already dead in the water, I think. I mean, everybody has things. Even if you're working on an awesome project that you're really motivated by, you're going to have moments where you're not motivated to do some specific thing about it. But if you still have that general sort of passion, you're going to be okay, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I think I would agree with all of those. Like, I think that's absolutely the most important, but...
If I was answering just as a designer, I might have different.
Well, yeah, from a design standpoint, I would say being really like agile and flexible and iterative is probably the most important thing for a small team. That's what makes us able to make a game like Berserkers. Is we're making something that I feel there's not a direct game exactly like ours. Like, we are being pretty experimental with things, and you can't do that on a big team where you're told exactly what to do. So. That kind of connects into like passion, like making sure people are working on the things that really excite them. And so that they're going to put out their best work.
Right.
And then I don't know. I think that the third one he probably already said.
Just go with that. That's a good call. All right. So I was just going to, I'm looking through my questions here. Is there a feature that you guys have put in that maybe didn't quite work out, that you're like, and it didn't quite reach what you were hoping the potential of it could be? Or is there something that you that hasn't made it in quite yet that you're really looking forward to that you can talk about as well? Or
there's
think of plenty of examples.
There's so many things kind of hard to pin down. I mean, we've experimented with so many things throughout the project. Early on, we tried pretty much any game mode you could possibly imagine in a multiplayer game. We've done capture flag.
I wasn't even going to bring that up. Yeah, I built like every game mode.
Yeah.
and now we're with simple ones.
Yeah, and we ended up going back to simple because our game is really primarily a combat game. And we found that small teams, small arenas actually plays better than big teams. I mean, what's the biggest we've had? Probably 20.
At least 24 people on a server.
24 people, and now our game is 4-on-4. You know, so we've tried the big team stuff, and there's also competitively, like, there are some games like Battlecry is a great looking game that's coming out. I think sometime the end of this year or something.
Yeah,
or next year. And they are going the big team route, very inspired by like the FPS genre in terms of their game modes. You can see how they've evolved from that and added in melee.
Right.
And we started to go that direction early on.
Well, we were first person.
And we were first person. That. Yeah.
Okay.
But a couple factors came in. First off, we liked the smaller style. When we made our 2-on-2 arena, 4 packs, we're like, holy shit, this is more fun than the big team stuff we've been doing.
Yeah. Right.
And that really influenced our direction. First person we went with, and we were pretty convinced that that would help kind of set the game apart from competition.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as we tried third person, we knew that was the route to go.
I was going to ask actually about that, because you do have the first person stuff with like Chivalry you were talking about before. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have like games like Mountain Blade and War of the Roses and stuff like that too. What about it made you go like, okay, we have to do third person. We can't do the first. What specifically drove you to that conclusion?
I have some thoughts about this, actually. Cool. So one of the things I think for me that happened right away was, so a lot of people say, oh, the game felt better. And that's a very general thing to say. And it's also applicable. But our game is, in a lot of ways, any melee game is about positioning and knowing where you are in relation to other characters around you.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big things that happened when you pop out in a third person is that you're much more aware of what's going on around your character. In first person, whatever your FOV is, if it's usually not bigger than like 110 is probably the highest you go.
Right.
And that means you're still a third of, you're seeing a third of what's happening around you at best. And
gives you tunnel vision for sure.
Right. And so if you get attacked from behind, then you have to turn all the way around to even just see who's there or what's happening before you can even react to it. And being in third person, I think, just gives you a better idea of what is happening in the game. And that helped make it feel a lot better. I mean, there's a lot of other nice things about it, just seeing your own character and all those other things. But I think that at the core of what our game is what made it feel better.
Okay.
Also artistically, we know we want to provide customization. I mean, when we showed the game off at PAX, people were like, can we buy hats? Like,
Yeah. Well, like going back to your earlier question about what features we want to get in,
yeah.
I think Will's going to touch on some of that stuff.
Yeah, we definitely plan on doing progression. And included in progression is customization of the character. We just think it fits with the style. Like, there's so much fun stuff you can do. Like, our characters right now are kind of like the base archetypes for different classes and body proportions. But there's so much fun things you can do and to add to the humor to allow people to customize their helmets. So I think we're still early on talks about this, but the kind of plan is to offer helmets, probably like skin changes, and then allow like weapon customization.
Cool.
So that's going to give a ton of variety right from the get-go. And third person is great for customization because you actually get to see your character. That's always been a complaint of mine with TF2. Like, I love the way they do customization is amazing.
Right.
But when I put on a hat and then I'm in first person, I don't even get to see it.
You never see it. Yeah.
Yeah, unless you're like taunting or dancing or whatever, you know.
Right.
When you're in third person, you immediately get to see the results of what you're customizing, not just in a menu or not just in a certain circumstance.
You know? Or when you're dead.
Right.
Exactly. So one of the other questions I wanted to ask as well was, what advice do you guys have for aspiring designers or producers? How should they get into the industry? What things do they need to read, study? What schools do they need to go to? Do they need to go to school? Like, what would you recommend for those people?
That's an interesting question. I think my answer has changed over the years. Like, I actually went to game development school. I went to Guildhall at SMU, like right when it first started. Mm-hmm. It was in the third ever class. That was about 10 years ago. Actually 10 years ago on the dot. And back then, there weren't a lot of game schools. So basically, as soon as we graduated, everybody got hired because there wasn't any other option. Like, people either went through QA and worked their way up, like grinding through the industry, or they did some amazing mod project and got found, or they would go to these schools, you know, like DigiPen, Full Sail, and Guildhall. I think we're really the only schools that exist. Nowadays, almost every state university has a game development.
It's getting there,
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think that really changes the game because now the competition coming out of school is so high. Like, I feel like with the portfolio I had, I wouldn't be able to get a job if if there were that many schools at that time.
Yeah.
So I think you really have to stand out. And I think that means more than ever, if you're getting right into the industry, if you want to go AAA, you have to specialize and become really, really awesome at just one job, you know.
Interesting. So let's talk about that a little bit because, and we'll get to you, Vince, I swear.
Yeah, that's fine.
Because I was talking with, there was an artist that I talked with at Riot, I think it was last week, and he was kind of saying that you should do the same thing. You should kind of aim for one sort of style and just stick with that style because they would get, you know, resumes at various places and they would look at them and go like, well, he can kind of do the realistic thing and he can kind of do the stylized cartoony and he can kind of do, you know, whatever.
But he's not amazing at anyone.
Right. Right. You know, jack of all trades.
Master or she.
So your recommendation would be to look into a specific genre. What do you mean like level designer? Do you mean like character designer? Like what specifically, what genres can people go into for a designer?
I think, as a designer, it's kind of hard to break right into game design. And that's been true even for the past 10 years. Level design is usually an entry point or like a junior systems designer, but those jobs are harder and harder to get. I think if you're going to go in, you have to figure out what you want to work on, right? So if you want to go into mobile, you need to look at the top mobile games, who actually is hiring, right? So if you want to work on something like Clash of Clans, you need to know monetization. You need to know like what really drives their games. And that's completely different than being a level designer on Call of Duty, right? Yeah, absolutely. You're not even going to have to think about that kind of stuff. You're going to be very focused on building architecture, building space,
sight lines.
Even the difference between a single player level designer and a multiplayer level designer, you're thinking about completely different things.
Yeah.
And, so it really sucks that you have to specialize because, sometimes people don't really know what they want to do until they get into the industry.
Right.
But it's kind of a catch-22 now where to even get noticed, you have to be so good at least one particular thing to get the job in the first place.
Right. Yeah. I think also one of the things that I have found, is that there are a lot of people like, so I got my start at Disney Interactive as a production assistant, being a producer, basically like a tiny producer, and then work my way up. But then I got a job out at a company in Utah called Sensory Sweep Studios as a game designer. Mm-hmm. Terrible company. We made awful games. Like nobody wants to get in the industry to make awful games. But sometimes what you have to do is get your start somewhere.
Yeah, but you were designing stuff.
But I was designing stuff.
Yeah,
it was in the middle of nowhere in Utah. But right. I was designing stuff. So that also might be something for you guys out there that are trying to get in and figure it out. Maybe you won't work at Epic Games immediately when you're trying to get in, or maybe you won't work at Blizzard right away, but maybe you can get your start at a smaller company that is hungry for, you know, people, and they can't pay as much as those guys, but you know what? You're going to get it on your resume, and you, as long as you work your ass off, this is the thing I actually love about the video game industry. And it doesn't always work out it took me a long time to get to kind of where I felt like I was comfortable and I could, you know, go to another place and get a job doing what I do. But if you work your ass off, typically people notice that, and you will be rewarded in the sense that other people will want you on your team and go like, you know what, this guy rocks. So he's motivated, like you were talking about, he's passionate, like we need to get him on the team. So as long as you give a damn and you can, you don't have to be a brilliant jerk like you were kind of talking about earlier. You'd rather have somebody who's kind of like, they're okay at their job, but they're super motivated.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the cool thing about the games industry, is if you can be motivated and give a damn, at least you'll kind of go somewhere. So start somewhere small, maybe, and kind of work your way up if you want to get into games.
And having experience puts you a notch above all the people trying to just break in.
Yeah.
Having like shipping a game or staying with the project until it's finished is really respected in the industry. And the more experience you have, I think the broader your horizons are and the more you can kind of diverge out of what you're doing. But I just see, like, especially in AAA, the industry gets more and more specialized every year.
Yeah.
I mean, at some point there's going to be someone that just paints hubcaps for a game.
Right? You know? Yeah. I mean, WildStar, we had a props team. We had a character art team. Yeah. We had, you know, a level building team. We had, I mean, these artists just did specific things. And same with designers. We had system designers. Mm-hmm. We had creature encounter designers. We had, you know, just gameplay scripting for, you know, testing classes and things like that. It was all specialized, and that all kind of comes from, you know, these needs for specific designers that know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's usually on bigger games, though. I think on smaller games, it's a little bit easier to kind of be more broad. But
on a small team, you kind of have to go outside your comfort zone because there's usually not someone to do that job. So you just have to kind of do it, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a lot about design. What about production? What if you're trying to get in, you want to be a producer, how do you get your start?
Well, let's see. I'll talk about how I got my start.
Okay.
And then we can kind of go from there. Cause like Will said, the industry has changed a lot. And it's interesting to me, for instance, that you got your start as a production assistant right off the bat at Disney, you were mentioning earlier. So for me, I, did not have a degree from a game development school or anything. I didn't go to any of those types of universities. I just went, basically, I went to school and I got a degree, but it has nothing to do with game development. And I got a job. My start was in QA at Activision, working the night shift. So basically, I was willing to do any job I could get in the industry to get into the industry was my attitude. And I was working, if we weren't in crunch, I was working from 5:30 p.m. I think till 2:30 a.m. was my shift. And basically grinded my way through that and worked my way up and networked and, you know, was always talking to the producers that were running the projects and just working my way up the QA ranks into the different, you know, like roles and responsibilities that you can have in QA. And eventually, after a couple of years, got a gig as a production coordinator on a project. My first project as in that was, I think, Spider-Man 3.
Cool.
And was a production coordinator and then worked my way up through the ranks of production.
Wait, did you know Chad Moore?
It sounds familiar.
He was so he worked on WildStar as a creative director now, but he was my first guest on the podcast, actually. So he worked as, I think, the lead character artist on Spider-Man 3.
Oh, was he at Treyarch?
Yeah, he was at Treyarch.
Oh, I wasn't at Treyarch. I was at Activision.
Okay, so you're on the publishing side.
Yeah, so I was like a publishing producer that would be squirreled away at the publishing building and not allowed into the developer if at all possible.
Really quick to further interrupt you, what is the difference between a publishing producer and a development producer?
All right, so here's the thing about production. It's different everywhere. There are no standards anywhere. So every company handles that title and role in different ways.
Right.
So for me, I can talk about how it was at Activision. I think it's still this way. I haven't been there in a while. But basically, the publishing production team and the development production team interact with each other every day and work together. But the publishing team basically handles the marketing, sales, PR, all the asks from those departments. They're the interface for all of the publishing departments to the developer.
Okay.
So if somebody on the marketing team needs like screenshots or something, then they would go to the publishing production team and say, "Hey guys, we need screenshots." And typically what the publishing production team would do is handle that request if at all possible without bothering the developer. It was the shield for the developer essentially to just basically say, "We're going to take care of everything we can. We're going to represent you guys to all these groups and try to just let you focus as much as possible on the game and not bother you with all of these requests that we need." And I think, you know, that company, as much as people talk a lot of shit about them and they get a lot of crap, I think they do a really good job in publishing the games and the projects that they believe on. They
put out a couple of good titles, I guess. Call of Duty. Maybe you've heard of that game.
I don't know. I mean, you know, the publishing teams there, I think, do a really, really good job with that stuff. And like I said, the production team on the publishing side is there to protect the developer and get those publishing groups what they need so that they can do that job.
Awesome. Okay.
And then the development side is sort of what you'd probably more expect as a production role, which is, a lot of stuff we've been talking about: project management, managing different teams. Different developers also handle production differently. So, you know, you might have I've worked with a lot of developers. So that's what was cool actually about being a production publishing producer, was that I worked with a lot of developers throughout my career. I worked with maybe like 10 to 12 different development studios and got a lot of exposure into how they do things, which was awesome. But they all kind of do stuff differently too, but it's more of the task management, project management type stuff on the development side usually.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so to continue.
Sorry, I'm a little long-winded sometimes.
No, that's fine. So you got in, you start working your way up, you're at Activision.
Yeah.
And then?
So I was at Activision a long time, in total almost 10 years. And then I went over, and like I was mentioning earlier, Greg sniped me over into Blizzard to work on some stuff there, and then we did Shield Break. But to talk about like advice for somebody, I want to be a producer, you know, maybe they've done some research. I think,
I can't remember the name of the video series. They did a really good job on what a producer is.
Is this the one that's on the
Extra PAX Credit website? I think. Extra Credit. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great video.
Actually. Great resource, I think, for anybody if they're just like, what does this person do in the industry? They have really good videos that talk about it. And they address this thing of like, oh, there's all these different titles and different companies do this differently, which is worth checking out. So I guess, you know, my advice would be to get into one of these, if possible, programs. I mean, I know USC has a really, really good program locally for game development. Yeah. And I know that they do actual projects and have people who are, quote, producers for projects. They probably rotate people around. Right. Maybe they call them project leads or something like that. But it's sort of like you are the person responsible for this project. And if it doesn't hit its time or whatever, then it's, you know, it's your fault. You're the one that sort of has to carry, I call it responsibility without authority. A lot of times yes. you're responsible yeah. for stuff that you sometimes don't have the authority to carry out. Or, yeah. So, but you're the one that sort of has to convince the team, you know, hey, we're not going to make our date. So guys, we got to think about, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going to change it?
Yeah. The way that I kind of look at producers is they are sort of advocates for the consumer at some point, you know, to kind of say like, hey, just to be clear, like I know that, because there's a lot of times where, and you know, I've done this as a level designer or a game designer where I have my special thing and I absolutely love it and I'm like, this is my thing and it's beautiful and everybody will enjoy it. And maybe you get so close to it that you don't really know that once it hits the fan and people actually play it, that maybe they won't like it as much. And yeah. I think the producer is kind of that can provide that sort of like, hey, you know, just to let you know that maybe that won't work out as well. But you can't be the one saying like, no, you're not going to do that. That's
right.
Because that's not your job. Your job is to just make sure that things get done and that they're yep. at a certain level of quality. But you have to convince people that that level of quality could mean a few things, you know, and yeah. whether it's based on anecdotal evidence or things you've seen on Twitch or, you know, game yep. trends that are happening right now. It's a weird position. It's very strange. Like, I feel like it's the one position that people outside of the industry are like, what does a producer even do? Like,
right. And I don't think there's any good analogy to another industry yeah. for it either, which is also problematic.
Yeah. Even when the describing movie industry is way different for, you know, what they do on the yeah. production side of things.
And I would say on a team, there's a huge difference between a producer who's really good at their job and a producer who isn't. I've worked with both and it can make the difference between a project succeeding and not.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Like if you have a producer that is terrible, it can mean bad things versus a producer that really understands what the game needs and what the team needs is a big thing.
We all joke about Vince on the team because like James, whenever he introduces Vince, he's like, hey, this is Vince. He's our producer, but not the producer you're thinking. He actually does stuff.
don't judge him. He's a good guy. Right. No,
don't hold it against him.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah, that is the, I've been introduced in a similar fashion. So I know what you mean. Okay, well, that was great. Thank you for that.
No problem.
So what have you guys picked up in your experience? Because you've both worked on some pretty impressive projects. What have you picked up from, say, like Activision and Blizzard that you've carried over here to Shieldbreak?
So one of the things, like I mentioned earlier, I've worked with a lot of different developers and seen how they do things. And I think what I've learned the most is there is no right way to make a game. There is no good way, right way, whatever. It's different for every single project. Even with the same team, it could be different. And the most important thing, I think, is to be aware of that and to allow the team to become the best it can be. And what I mean by that is don't try to force structure onto a team because it worked, because you did it that way before, or because XYZ or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like the developers that I've worked with that have the most churn, like the most people leaving and the most issues, are the ones that do that. They say, right. This is the way we've always done things. We're going to do it this way, no matter what. Doesn't matter. This is exactly how we do it. Right. And to me, that means, you know, that you're not looking at it as a holistic project and picture. So that to me was a big thing, like from those learnings and especially like when I went to Blizzard and saw how all the different teams of Blizzards do things, it's very much like, okay, you know, pick something, try to have some, you know, you have to have some structure and guidance and you want to figure out what to do, but don't get married to it. You know, don't, don't think that it can't change or get better or improve as you go along. So I'd say for me, at least, that was that's the biggest takeaway I've had from my experience. Because I definitely didn't have any sort of hardcore in-depth development experience until, I went to Blizzard.
Yeah. I think working on really big projects, the thing that you learn the most is just, you know, not to get married to your work, because on a huge project, like a Call of Duty project, there are so many people working on that and there's so many different responsibilities, and you can't get married to the one thing because it may not fit into the grander scheme of the game.
Right.
The other thing is just quality, like working on COD, working on Halo, the push for quality is so high. There's a high bar. You have to meet the standards of the previous games, which are massive hits, you know.
Yeah.
And there's always a push to kind of push it forward, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a very demanding job for sure, but it can also be really rewarding. Getting to see that game on the shelves and see people, you know, play your maps or play the content that you made is really rewarding for sure.
So speaking from the level design perspective, what did you bring from your experience on Halo and Call of Duty to Berserkers?
Well, what's funny is our levels in Berserkers are so simple in comparison that they're almost like WoW Arena. And we initially started making like big FPS style maps, but we just found that the type of game that we're building doesn't fit. So ironically, a lot of it doesn't carry over.
Interesting. Okay.
Halo is a little more applicable because they have smaller team sizes, you know.
Right.
Original Halo was 4-on-4, which right. is the same that we're doing.
Yeah.
But we aren't doing long sight lines with sniping and things like that.
So let's talk about the difference between like a WoW arena versus a first person shooter. Because I think this is super interesting, because mm-hmm. as you were saying, you want to have people that kind of get into specialty roles and things like that. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between those two? And I know they're different genres, but
right.
specifically, like, what do you look for to be successful in a first person shooter level design mm-hmm. versus like a WoW arena or like a, you know, kind of MMO sort style. Of PvP sort of thing.
Well, I actually worked on MMOs originally. Like, my first project was Tabula Rasa, which bombed really bad, but it was a great learning experience. And actually, the people on the team have gone on to do really great things. Like, super talented team,
right?
Put into a bad situation.
Yeah, sure.
So, I think the first thing you think about when doing levels is the core mechanics of the game is what drives level design.
Right.
So MMO combat is very different from FPS combat. So you have to think about things like, is the game ranged? Is it melee? Is there even combat, right? Like a puzzle game, like the Talos Principle is a very different level style than something that's competitive shooter.
Right.
Or something that's narrative driven, where you're taking along a path to deliver story and content, is very different than an arena in WoW. So the core mechanics always drive the level. And so if we're talking about like WoW arena, there's a very small teams, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 5-versus-5. So you need spaces that are small enough to make it interesting for only 4 people to be fighting in.
Right.
And you want the spaces to kind of work with the combat system. So something that's important in World of Warcraft is sight lines, just like a shooter.
Right.
Except it's not about, you know, sniping down a lane. It's about blocking someone's vision of you just for brief moments. So their levels tend to have like small columns or just a little bit of incline where you can use the terrain or the space to your advantage to briefly get out of sight. But they never make it so that you don't know where the other team is.
Right.
It's very obvious how to get to them. It's also like the action is immediate. Right when the doors open, you see each other.
Right.
And you can start attacking each other.
Right. So how much of when you're designing these things, do you have a strategy in mind for what you're trying to get the player to do versus how much do they figure out their own strategy and you're like, oh, shit, I didn't even think of that.
That's always going to happen. Even once you've shipped a game, like you, as an example on Berserkers, we've been working on it for, you know, a little over a year.
Yeah.
And so collectively as a team, each of us have probably 500 hours of playing this game, you know.
Damn.
So we're definitely expert level players, but as soon as the game comes out, people are going to do stuff that we never did in all the hours that we played. They'll find bugs, they'll find exploits, they'll find strategies that we never thought of. And
everything you think that they're not going to find, they're going to find. Yeah. If you ever put something in and you're like, ah, oh, there's this thing, but no one will see it. They will guaranteed see it day one.
Yeah, absolutely. and that's actually the really exciting thing about multiplayer is that the game is ever changing. You know, balance tweaks will happen. It's not just you put the game out and that's that. Like we are built to react to those and actually encourage it in some instances and then nerf it if we need to. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, gentlemen, I think we're running close to our time here. I wanted to say thank you so much for coming on and talking with everybody. And what's the plug for you guys? Where do people need to go to check out the game?
Oh, so go to our website, beerzerkers.com. We'd love to have your audience sign up for our alpha. We're still taking signups and we're pretty much letting everybody in throughout the different phases. We're planning on doing another alpha test sometime this month. So
awesome.
They go sign up, they'll get in, they can play the game this month for free and help us test it, make it better, give us feedback, all that good stuff.
Fantastic. Gentlemen, once again, thank you. And
thank you.
And thank you for listening to the show. If you want to find out more information, please check out our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/Stephen Frost. And thank you again for checking out the show. We'll see you guys next time. Adios.